Well, Park City resident Becky Yee has a new lease on life. That after a revolutionary surgery to implant a sort of pacemaker in her brain just weeks ago. Becky joins me now in the studio to explain. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So give us the backstory. I mean, it's been several years. You were vibrant, active, working, traveling, biking, skiing, and then what happened?
I realize looking back now, for most of my life, and for sure 20 years ago, I started a 10-year period where I occasionally couldn't run. And I would just kind of blow that off as a bad day and go back to what I was doing, which was running marathons at the level of qualifying for Boston. I did one iron distance triathlon. And then about 10 years ago, I thought, okay, I turned 55 to date myself. And I decided I'm going to clean up on the triathlon circuit. I entered all kinds of things. I trained hard all winter. In March, I could still race. And in April, I was limping. I still did a half iron that I managed to qualify for world championships, but you had to pay your money right then. And I declined because I didn't know how my running would go. And it turns out 10 years later, I was still not able to run. Or mountain bike, the things I did with you, my life kind of really went downhill because when that's what you do, it's really difficult to not be even able to go to the grocery store.
Yeah, so it came on slowly.
Very slowly, essentially over my lifetime. It started with what's known as writer's cramp. And people say writer's cramp lightly because they've written a bunch of things and say, oh my gosh, I have writer's cramp. True writer's cramp is when your muscle seizes and your arm hurts the second you pick up a pen and you probably can't even hold it. I was down to holding a pen in my fist to write like a 2-year-old might hold a crayon.
So you were tested for a host of things, as I recall, Parkinson's, MS, I guess all negative and still no diagnosis?
Yes. And then my diagnosis was, we don't know, go live your life the best you can, or you can have a bad day running, or here, try all these drugs. I've tried dozens of drugs in my life that generally the side effects were worse than, and didn't help either.
Yeah. So you went undiagnosed then for how long?
At least the last 15 to 20 years of having symptoms bad enough that it needed a diagnosis. And my doctor at the time, I thought he was working really hard. He started out trying dopamine on me, which is a neurotransmitter, which actually helped. So we were all excited about that, but then it didn't keep helping enough. So he finally decided I had full-blown Parkinson's. And then he tried drugs for that, which actually just made me feel worse and worse. And then he decided, since some days I seemed better and some days I seemed worse. And as orphan diseases, and especially women, are often diagnosed, that it was a psychological disorder. And that is how I got referred to the National Institutes of Health, or NIH for short, in Bethesda, Maryland, for a study for psychogenic disorders that appear as a neurological disorder. And that's how I managed to get in with NIH 5 years ago.
And you were still at that point undiagnosed.
Yes. So for this study, I had about a 2-day workup with various doctors doing various things within the institute. And then they take you in front of kind of their grand rounds and their principal investigator, who is very well known in neurological circles. And I thought, oh my gosh, he's going to think I'm so bad. He's going to slap me right into the inpatient unit. But I thought, you know, fine, I'll get better. So I was kind of preparing myself for that. And then after all the looking at me, he came out and said, you have dystonia. And at the time he called it multifocal, which means my hand, my leg, various things that seem unconnected, but that were all a form of dystonia, which as an easy way of describing it, I call it motion-activated muscle seizure. As soon as you start to use a muscle, it seizes. And my hand, I didn't even really care so much. It's like, don't write, don't pick anything up. But my leg, I couldn't bike, I couldn't run, and it got where I couldn't walk because my leg was so seized up.
So what was that like? I mean, for a very active woman to barely being able to get out of bed?
Seriously, it was like sit home and cry sometimes. I could walk around the house, but then I would realize that for days I had not gone out of the house. And most of the time, I did not go upstairs during the day. Once I came downstairs, that was it. If we had something in the kitchen I could cook, I cooked dinner. Sometimes I could go to the grocery store, but I couldn't go to the grocery store and cook on the same day. So very limiting and very isolating.
So then you were accepted then into another trial. Tell me about that.
My local neurologist had suggested that I consider this deep brain stimulation implant about a year ago, but it's not without risk. It's not rocket science, but it is brain surgery. And it probably took me a year to get to the point of even thinking about it seriously. So then I started researching articles, as anyone, or especially someone with a science background like me, might do. And I saw there were research articles by NIH. So I started looking into those, and then I saw they had open enrollment for dystonia patients for this surgery, and I just jumped in. And that was in September.
So tell me about what you had done 6 weeks ago. This deep
first
brain,
thing, yes, it is a surgery. I think the worst part, and a lot of people have been through this, and they have done the surgery for Parkinson's patients, and dystonia is just sort of a new frontier along that line. First, they bolt a steel cage to your head, which I say was the very worst part. And then they put you to sleep, and there's a borehole in the top of my head and behind my ear. And a little wire is run down to a part of my brain called the globus pallidus interna, which is where movement is regulated, or at least my type of movement. And there's a little wire and a little strip there with four tiny little nodes on it, and that's where they can send electrical current. And then a telephone-sized cable runs under my skin, down my head, into my chest, where they implanted a matchbox size implant that's a rechargeable battery. So every night now I have a charger, it's called an antenna, that's about the size of a small saucer that I place over that spot, and then it's connected to what you might think of as a remote charger, just like you might charge your cell phone remotely. And then I have to charge that up by plugging it into another unit that may be plugged into the wall. But I don't really want to plug myself into the wall in tandem, although I could. And so they let me heal from the surgery for a month, and I think I did need that whole month. And I went back to NIH 2 weeks ago, and they turned it on, and they charged up the voltage on all four nodes until I was having side effects that were unwanted, such as I could not speak, or my mouth was pulled sideways, or my foot would tingle. And then how they left it was they left only one node turned on at 2.2 volts. And they said dystonia patients often don't notice any difference for maybe even months. So I was prepared to not notice any difference, but still go through everything I had to go through. Well, lo and behold, just the fact that this little wire and strip were on my brain part, it's called lesion effect, I already could walk better. Instead of barely walking two blocks and my husband essentially helping drag me or literally pulling my leg forward, we went out and walked a couple miles, which was just astounding. And then after they turned the charge on, not only could I walk, I've gone back to cross-country skiing. I'm regaining strength and balance and the happiness that that can bring you.
Yeah, I can't even imagine, right? I mean, just from, right?
A mutual friend of ours, yours and mine, last week we went somewhere. I bopped up the stairs without holding the rail. I went down the stairs with a cup of coffee in my hand. And she just gasped. And she said, you know, that just nearly brings me to tears. And literally the doctor at NIH who had examined me right before seeing me and turning this on, and then walking me watch down the hall right after, she nearly burst into tears too. It's that big of a difference.
So how is it for you? I mean, do you live just being grateful that, oh my gosh, I have my life back? Or is there some fear that, oh my gosh, is it going to stop working? Or maybe a
really
little
right
both?
Now, my worst fear is slipping on the ice and hitting my head on that side of my head. But no, I'm so grateful. I'm almost to the point of tears now. But it's a risky surgery. 1-2% of people can have a stroke and end up worse than they were. And I'm glad now I made the decision, but it was a really hard decision to make. But I was at the point of, do I do this or do I see myself in a wheelchair?
Yeah, because that's where it was headed.
And as most of you listening probably know, in Park City, most of us are not going to be in like the Olympians all around us. But we intend to keep moving until we're dead.
You know, I saw a recent Facebook post of yours that mentioned how badly things could have gone. I think you had a roommate back east in Bethesda. Had her incident happened during the government shutdown, because NIH is a federal program.
Federal program. It's a large part of Health and Human Services. Their budget is always looking at being cut, which would involve jobs and research. When the government is shut down, that also affects whether they bring new people into a study or unplanned people into the clinical center, which that clinical center in Bethesda is the largest clinical research center in the world. And luckily, we were there before the shutdown. She has a disorder which makes multiple tumors in her body, and she had literally been put on palliative care back where she lived, but then they brought her in for emergency brain surgery. And if that had happened 2 weeks later during the shutdown, they probably would not have brought her in. And I think people don't realize things like that literally affect life and death for some people.
Yeah, that's incredible. So what's the outlook here? I mean, what's your doctor's reactions?
My local doctor just says I'd be one too many cooks in the kitchen, so I don't see her. But I will go back to NIH every 4 weeks for a few more months and then every 3 months. And I can actually, with a remote controller, I have a remote control for myself now, I can control that to some extent myself, and especially in tandem with talking with them, to turn a charge up or down. And since this first little charge on one node has been so helpful, I can't imagine what will happen next. Will the next one help more, or will they say, you're doing so great, we don't have to, or we'll turn the other ones on just a little bit where we don't notice it so much? So I don't know what to expect, and I go back in 2 weeks and I will find out.
So does the implant in the brain, that stays forever? The only hardware that would need to change would be the stuff outside your body?
The remote control battery pocket is supposed to last about 15 years, and I'm hoping the charging mechanism gets improved over those years, because it's pretty clunky. And my husband Benny, who's a software engineer and also a biomedical engineer, looks at it and about blows his brain and says, why is this so clunky? But it's probably what got approved by the FDA. And I'm thinking right now to tie this into the Sundance Film Festival, which is going on all around us, literally outside the window. The slogan this year is Risk Independence. And I saw a quote yesterday by Robert Redford who said, "Risk is the catalyst that propels you forward." And that spoke directly to me.
Well, it's so great to see you up and about, healthy, bringing tears to my eyes.
I know, seriously. Everyone I talk to, it brings a little tear to their eye, and mine too.
Yeah, just knowing you so long. So congratulations.
And I hope we're back out biking this summer.
Okay, hope so. Becky, thanks for your time and your story. Well, after more than a year of meetings, the Kimball Junction Blue Ribbon Committee is ready to kick off its recommendations next month. In the studio with a preview of the work that they have done and what to expect, I have a member of that committee, Pete Gilwald, owner of Land Solutions Planning and Design. Good morning.
Good morning.
So talk to us a little bit who's on this committee.
Well, the committee is made up of a lot of different constituents that would be using the Kimball Junction area. So there's, you know, we had staff with Pat Putt and Peter Barnes and Jennifer Strader and Ray Milner. We had people like myself from the public, Chris Conaby. And then we also had landowners and people that are the property managers down in the Kimball Junction area. So trying to get a broad view of all the various user groups and what their issues may be and how we can move forward with it.
Yeah, so what were you tasked with?
Well, we started off with looking at the two halves of Kimball Junction and what are some of the positives that you have as your experience there, and then what are the negative aspects? Things like, you know, pedestrian connectivity, you know, walking from the Petco to World Market is not the greatest experience, or sidewalks that don't go anywhere. So we looked at trying to identify those kind of issues and then trying to work through how we might resolve those.
Yeah. And again, we had wide open spaces to plan this. I mean, was it just somebody not looking at the big picture and everything was just done so piecemeal that we didn't realize?
Well,
what we
I
were
think
building?
There's some of that, you know, when they did the redo of the spa by the World Market, you know, their efforts to create a more walkable community were hampered by property lines. And, you know, this owner and this owner may not have been on the same page. And so, you know, where the Jimmy John's and all that is, that's all based on property lines, not on a cohesive design. So between New Park and Redstone and the village, there's just a lot of different moving parts.
Yeah. So in terms of how much more there is left to build there at Redstone and New Park, I mean, is it built out?
For the most part, it is. I think, you know, the largest tract that we looked at is the Park City Tech Center, you know, and that being the largest piece that's still undeveloped that has a development agreement with the county and so on and so forth. And it was recently changed ownership, so Boyer is no longer the owner of the property, and the new owner is looking to see what the options are.
Yeah. So was it important that the property owners are on this committee, given that, you know, they're going to try and get as much density as possible?
Well, if, you know, the things that we're looking to do are not inexpensive. You know, if the goal is to create a nice pedestrian connection throughout New Park, you know, the large parking lots of asphalt that kind of inhibit that, if we go to structured parking, that's a high dollar endeavor, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 a parking space. So in order to incentivize the developers to do these kind of improvements, is there, you know, we have to keep them involved in the process.
Yeah. So can you talk to us a little about some of those improvements that are being considered at least thrown out on the table?
Well, what we're looking at is ultimately, what we're doing is amending the general plan, because right now in the general plan, the Kimball Junction plan is about a half a page long. With the new draft, it's about 20 pages long. So it outlines goals and objectives, and we dialed down to how do we fix this sidewalk or how do we do whatever. We brought in representatives from UDOT to talk to us about traffic and 224, which, you know, that corridor through there can be quite a mess at times. And their message to us was, if you want UDOT to get involved, the community has to be involved. So you have to show and demonstrate to UDOT that there's a commitment from county council staff, from Park City Municipal, and from the local citizens that this problem needs to be addressed. And they've committed to help fund a 224 corridor study.
So you do have buy-in then from the property owners?
Yes, we had, you know, several of them on the committee, and they recognize that there are opportunities down in that area, and with opportunities comes the possibility for, you know, investment and expanding the space down there.
Yeah, so they're not necessarily on the line to pay for this, or would they pay for some of it, and then some of it coming from those sales taxes that residents approved a couple years ago?
I believe it'd be multiple sources. You know, one of the things I told Pat when we first read the report was there's not a lot of mention of government involvement. And I think government is going to have to play a role because, again, things like parking structures and sort of doing regional road improvements are out of the purview of any one individual developer, but certainly they have a role. And so, again, we've gotten positive feedback so far.
Yeah. So are we talking about this parking garage then on the Kimball Junction Transit side of things?
There could be one there. When we did if you remember a couple of years ago, there was a park and ride committee that looked at possible locations. And one of the spots we identified was next to the Sheldon Richards building in conjunction with the transit center.
Yeah. So when does this get rolled out then to the public? Next month, I mentioned, but what's going to happen here?
So we have a public hearing scheduled with the Planning Commission on the 12th of February. And at that point, it's available now, I believe, on the county's website to read it. And we're looking for the public to come out and ask questions. They did a brief kickoff at the last Planning Commission meeting, and we had one member from an HOA get up and have a few comments about hopefully not adding too much density, but at the same, yeah. So we have started getting a little bit of feedback, but it all starts on the 12th.
Okay. And again, that's kind of, you do have a plan to present, or you're just going to present the code amendments and the Kimball Junction community, or the neighborhood plan, I think is what it's called.
Yeah. So we're going to introduce the plan, and then, assuming it gets through the process with the Planning Commission and City Council or County Council and gets adopted as part of the general plan, then the next step for staff is to create the MPD process and whatever code amendments would need to be in place to actually implement some of these ideas.
Okay. So February 12th, people are interested, would be a good place to start.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not sure exactly what time on the 12th, but that's where it'll be.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention about the plan?
Well, part of the couple of big keynotes were they included the Utah Olympic Park as part of the planning area now. So looking at connections between the UOP and the Kimball Junction area. We looked at, this is a 20 to 30 year plan, so it's not like we're going to see backhoes and whatnot out there tomorrow starting to fix some of these problems, but it's looking 20 to 30 years down the road. It's keeping in mind that we're never going to get rid of the car, so we still have to plan for that. And the other thing that came out, Colin Hilton was on the committee as well, and he was looking at the whole idea of the possible 2030 Olympic Games, that they were to come to Salt Lake, as being maybe part of that impetus to kickstart some of these ideas. So it's a great opportunity for us to maybe use some of that energy.
Okay. Hey, Pete, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you, Leslie, and I've enjoyed Sundance immensely. We saw Devin Allman and Dwayne Betts last night.
Oh, awesome. That's Pete Gildwall again, owner of Land Solutions Planning and Design and a member of the Kimball Junction Blue Ribbon Committee. Well, we're about halfway through Sundance, and still to come are the 2019 FIS World Championships through February 10th in the studio to have a look at both. I have Jenny Dearson, Special Events Manager, along with Alfred Knotts, who is the Transportation Planning Manager. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's talk about how Sundance has gone so far. Things are pretty chill at this point. First weekend, though, Alfred, what was your assessment?
It was definitely busy, but I think our strategies have been well received. And we have some new options online with the Ecker Hill Park and Ride Lot, new services out there with the Lime Route, additional white, the 10 Express. And then we've also added additional bus service just through our Sundance contract also. So that and the communication, our traffic command center also is online. This is only the fourth week we've had that, really the second event or holiday season where it's been active. That's been very helpful for on-ground communication and observation and communication directly with UDOT. So I think everything and all intents and purposes has gone as planned. We obviously got a lot of weather right before that, so the snow removal and streets crews were very, very busy working throughout the clock or around the clock to clear the snow, to get the roads cut back, to get our sidewalks as clear as possible. So I think it's gone very well. So we'd like to hear from the community when everything's said and done and be able to improve for next year's event.
Yeah. So did you have to tap into that contract to bring on extra buses?
We did not. We did have a bus accident the night before, and this is what we were worried about, is that, you know, if we lose one or two buses, we're down. Our spare ratio is essentially zero. The industry standard is 20%. We're essentially at zero at these times, so we're very susceptible to decreases in service should we have another accident. So we haven't had to bring that online. We did get our buses delivered. That was the other contingency plan for the contract, is if we didn't get our three Proterras delivered in time, and they were delivered literally a day or two before, and that requires commissioning, insurance, and inspection clearance. So all that had to take place rather expeditiously. So we still have that contract in place in case we need anything for FIS and even going into the summer season to avoid any conflicts with our FTA, our charter requirements, which were prohibited from providing with federal dollars.
So are they smaller than the first ones?
They would be essentially the little buses that are out there right now. We would
the new Proterra ones. Are they smaller? Because it seems like I've seen some that just seem to be very much more maneuverable.
No, they're just a different type of battery layout and everything too. So they don't do the overhead charging. They do depot charging at the Iron Horse facility. So they do have a little bit of a different body, but the same capacity.
All right, and we got the charger thing straightened out?
Yeah.
A charger that can work for all buses?
Yes. I mean, we still have the overhead chargers for the existing Proterras, and then the new ones have more of an overnight charge that can have longer range and distance also. So we're constantly, this is bleeding edge technology, so we're constantly working through kind of some of the kinks and mechanical issues and some of the things that come with our cold climate and snow and then other issues. Sometimes we get snow that packs down underneath the overhead charger, and it's so sensitive that that can knock off the calibration. So we're going to look at next year providing potentially some snow melt under there and some other ways to mitigate that also. So little hiccups there and there, but nothing that I think that the public would actually feel.
Yeah. So, you know, I was mentioning to Diane Foster earlier this week about a couple that had told me it took them 2 hours to get to Main Street from the Colony. And she mentions, well, yeah, you know, get on a bus and you'll get here faster. At the same time, though, all of a sudden you get to Park City, and it doesn't matter if you're on a bus or not, because it's just crowded. I mean, there's one lane, and there's not a special lane for a bus as there is out on 224. So, I mean, what should people do?
Well, they're doing the right thing by still getting on the bus. Think if all those tens of thousands of people during this week were not on those buses, we would not be able to handle that capacity. So, you know, just being able to have that mode split, I don't think it's realistic anywhere, whether you're in New York City or San Francisco or anywhere, that 100% of the people are going to be on transit. But if those people were not on transit or on different modes or carpooling, essentially you're doubling the volume when we're already at capacity.
And I had heard that Lyft went down on Friday. Do you know what happened there?
I do not.
And just the communications? I don't know if it was a software problem.
I've been in direct communication both with our IT director at the city as well as Lyft, and I think there were some connectivity issues. I don't think at any point in time it actually went down. I do think, you know, some of what Alfred is saying is that definitely Friday and Saturday we hit busy peak times, specifically between 3 and 7 o'clock. And I think the more we focus on the change that our community is making and taking the efforts to take transit, to carpool, to take alternate modes of transportation, the amount of people walking specifically in the Old Town Core, you know, I think that's where we focus. And we continue to get that feedback from people of where we need to improve. And we put that in the debrief process, which we are already working on and will continue to do through the next 6 weeks before we bring that back to the community and to council for a debrief of next steps.
Okay. So are people using the Acre Hill lot?
They are.
The county. There were 20, and so how many were you counting out there over the weekend?
Caroline sent me a text on Sunday. I think that they counted 200 out there. So we have a ground counter out there. We also have a ground counter out at Richardson Flat, so we'll have some more specific data. But I parked out there several times over the weekend, and it was rather full. So I think, you know, given the fact that it's been online since November, I think we're seeing a pretty good response to that. And that's typically not the case. So that's, you know, we recognize that all the times people aren't necessarily going to park out there unless there's some type of disincentive or incentive. So, and that would be that it's free. The transit system is free. It's convenient. And leave the driving to us.
Yeah. And just a great way to go experiment with it.
Yes. Yeah,
knowing that you couldn't get into town anyway. So with your car.
Yes.
Let's see, Homestake employee lot, is that filling up? Or?
So Homestake employee lot, you know, I drove past there the other morning at about 9 o'clock just to see what it looked like, and there are already 70 cars parked in there. So we are seeing very good utilization in that lot specifically. In the evenings, you know, Johnny Watson, our parking services manager, he has reported that it is full as well. Richardson Flat, we're seeing a slight increase daily over numbers compared to what we saw last year. So I think all in all, you know, our community and our visitors are using these alternate modes of transportation, and we appreciate that.
Yeah, so it's not going to be this year, but maybe not 2020, but maybe 2021 when that Homestake lot could go away for that use. Then what?
You know, I think as we get closer to that time period, we will look at what the next alternative is for that those employees on Main Street and those coming here to town and go from there.
Okay. And in response to some of the concern from last year, parking rates have gone down today. Tell me about that.
Yes, so we do change parking rates in China Bridge starting today. They will be $5 an hour starting after 11 a.m. So if you do need to run that morning errand, come grab a cup of coffee. China Bridge will be free until 11. And then after that, it is the $5 an hour with a max total of $40 through the day. The other lot flagpole does remain a flat rate of $40, and that's to encourage long-term parking there to help out the transit center and make sure buses can get out there. So there's not a lot of turnover over there at the flagpole lot.
Okay. Let's see. What else do you need to talk, wanted to say about Sundance? Anything before we look ahead at the World Championships?
You know, I just would like to say everyone out there, you know, it really takes a village to pull these things off between the police department, fire department, resort, school district, county. You know, everyone plays their role. And so thank you to everyone out there, to our community that are doing everything out there for these events.
Okay. And then with World Championships starting, what, Richardson goes away?
Richardson Flat will still be running. Saturday is the last day. So that's the day of opening ceremonies. There would be a transfer at the high school that then you would have to transfer again at the resort to get up to Canyon. So really, Richardson Flat is the best option if you are still attending movies and events with Sundance, really out in the county for canyons. It is Ecker Hill and continue to carpool. If you are skiing during the day on Saturday, we strongly encourage you to keep your car parked and then transfer to the Canyons Resort if you're not already there. And really, I think what I want to mention about Saturday is with both events going on, really, especially in the evening between 3 and 8 o'clock at night, think about how you're using the alternative modes of transportation and where you're going. That is the best option for Saturday for sure.
Well, and we know with World Championships and anything happening up at Deer Valley, I mean, there's lots of parking, but there's one lane to get there.
Yes.
And we have seen in years past, just for the Freestyle World Cup, things back all the way basically to 248.
Yeah, and so I think, too, after after 4 o'clock in the evening, the school districts are going to allow us to have parking at the school. Ecker Hill Middle School and McPullen are the best places for that, while Sundance is still going on. And then, you know, Deer Valley has worked incredibly hard with us this year in the summer, testing some mitigation strategies where we're actually sending cars in certain directions at the egress out of those Deer Valley parking lots. Police are in the intersection, and I would like to mention that. Make sure that you are aware of the police officers in that intersection up at Deer Valley. They are in a tough position, and they are trying to keep traffic moving. You know, we have a lot of community spirit up there on the hill cheering on the athletes that we have, and just make sure you plan some extra time to get out of there. When we tested things on September 3rd in the summer, things moved much more quickly than we've seen in the past. It still takes a little time to get out of there, but and then using the TCC to also, you know, make sure we're changing the lights at a better speed gets things moving.
Okay, so we won't run the Richardson bus on the second weekend of World Championships.
We will not. No, we kind of went back and forth and debated that, and just given the spread out of the venues and the requirement to transfer, we really don't think that it would be that cost effective. And we'll put those services to increasing service on the blue and on the red and on the yellow, and then I believe we're going to add another bus on the lime just based on the events for that evening to just to serve those other specific venues. So we are increasing service. We felt we would get more bang for our buck at the trying to get people in and around the venues rather than trying to bring people out and in. So we will still be serving the Ecker park and ride with additional service. And as Jenny said, carpooling is always could be one less car off the road at least. A very exciting event, international event from one to the next. So it's a very proud time for the town.
What happens with China Bridge in terms of parking rates there?
After Sundance, so starting on the 3rd, everything goes back to normal peak rates, and there are no changes during the FIS World Championships. There is a concert on Lower Main Street on February 10th. I'll be back, I think, next week to talk about that a little bit. But for that day specifically, no changes to parking rates.
Okay, and then what about the Homestake lot?
Homestake lot will continue to run starting at 8 a.m. throughout both events. And so employees coming to Main Street, it is, again, it's a busy time in our community. And so we wanted to do that to extend it through both events so that we can reduce the traffic throughout town.
All right. Tell me a little bit about the registration, though, to if you do want to park at Homestake, what needs to happen?
Main Street employees do need to email. I believe off the top of my head, it's homestakeparking@gmail.com. And you just need to do the make and model of your car with a license plate and where you work on Main Street, and then you'll get registered.
Okay. I mean, how do you know you're registered?
I believe that they reply and let you know that they've received the information.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Anything else, guys, you wanted to mention?
You know, I just want to thank everyone and for all the work they're doing out there. If you do have questions or feedback, please do not hesitate. Best way to do that is specialevents@parkcity.org. And then I also wanted to mention on the homepage, parkcity.org, we do have a transportation survey, and we would just love to hear your feedback. It's pretty simple. It takes about 5 minutes or less to fill that out.
Okay. Jenny Dearson, Alfred Knotts, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.